going to be getting into the whole matter of the Exodus next time, so I'd like to give kind of an overview of the Late Bronze Period, because the Exodus, according to our biblical chronology, occurred right at the beginning of the Late Bronze Period. I don't think I gave this handout out before. If it's a duplicate, well, pass it on to a friend. I might have given you one which had only two lists of dates of the 18th dynasty. I put in a third one just recently, and I can't remember if I gave that to you or not. So this gives us the rulers of Egypt during the time of the 18th dynasty, which is basically the Late Bronze Period. The 19th dynasty as well comes under the Late Bronze Period. And there's different chronological systems in use. The high chronology is one that was in use several decades back, and it's in the Cambridge Ancient History, so that makes it sort of an official chronology, and a lot of people still continue to use it. But more recent scholarship has tended to follow a lower chronology, dates that are slightly more recent. There's not a big difference, but it's, you know, 25 years or, you know, it's a number of years. And so the low chronology over on the right is from Kitchen, from this recent book on high, middle, and low. It was a colloquium held in 1987. And these represent the dates that he published at that time. Then there's one that's sort of a combination of the two. This one in the middle, Wentian van Sicklen. And I am sort of making use of that one because, as we will see when we talk about the Pharaoh of the Exodus, this particular chronology aligns with the Bible much better than low chronology does. So I'm staying with this center one for the moment, unless somebody totally disproves it. What that one does, it goes with the high chronology early in the 18th dynasty and then kind of switches over to the lower chronology toward the end of the 18th dynasty. We don't know the length of the reign of some of these pharaohs, so you know, you can juggle these numbers around somewhat. But as time goes by, I think we're closing in on it. But you need to know these pharaohs because they play a role in trying to reconstruct what was happening at the time of the Exodus and the conquest. Now, if you recall, when we talked about the Middle Bronze Period, I said that we can't really draw a precise line exactly when the Middle Bronze ends. And so different people have different definitions. And I think I talked about the theory of Albright, about the expulsion of the Hyksos and the Egyptian pharaohs chasing the Hyksos into Canaan, destroying all the cities. And if you go with that theory, you end the Middle Bronze about 1550 BC. But it looks more and more like that was not the case. In fact, there's no evidence to support that scenario. There's no Egyptian records other than the one isolated campaign to chase the Hyksos out when they were chased into Shar-o-Hen in southern Canaan. We don't know exactly where Shar-o-Hen is located. There's a couple of possibilities. But we do have the record of the Egyptians chasing the Hyksos to Shar-o-Hen. And for 3 years, they besieged that one place until finally they overpowered them and captured these Hyksos rulers and put them to death or somehow disposed of them so they were no longer a threat. From that event, which we can date, again, depending on your chronology, but the chronology I've taken would date that event to about 1560, the expulsion of the Hyksos. It's on your chronology chart that I handed out last time. From that time, down to the 22nd year of Thutmose III, if you follow the Wentian Vinciclan chronology, that would be the year 1483 BC, you have no Egyptian record of any campaign in Canaan. So you've got, about 80 years or so of evidently no campaign in Canaan. However, in the 22nd year of Thutmose III, he came into Canaan with the army and specifically targeted Megiddo up in the north, where there was headquartered a coalition of kings from the region, and they had their headquarters there, and he laid siege to Megiddo, and after 7 months took the city. And he made all these kings then swear allegiance to Thutmose III, and in his records he speaks not only of capturing Megiddo, but many, many, many other sites in Canaan. If you were to plot them on a map, they are all sites along the coastal plain and along the Esdraelon Jezreel Valley. These were the areas of the trade route. And Thutmose, of course, wanted to secure these areas for his own expeditions, military expeditions, and for commercial reasons. He doesn't record any penetration into the central hill country, that's where the Israelites were, or up in the Galilee, which also was an area occupied by the Israelites. Now, some people have said that the book of Judges cannot be an accurate reflection of the late Bronze period because there's no mention of the Egyptians, and everybody knows the Egyptians were in control of Canaan at this time. From that campaign onwards, then, Canaan is an Egyptian province under the control of the Egyptians. But if you really understand the circumstances and the situation, you see that the Egyptians had little to do with the Central Hill Country. They had no reason to meddle in the affairs of the people in the Central Hill Country. They weren't interested in it. They wanted to hold the trade routes and the passageways that the army would be using. Egypt at this time was involved in a struggle with the Hittites over Syria, basically. Canaan wasn't a problem. And they were campaigning further north most of the time. And they would only come into Canaan if there was a problem there. If there was a revolt or something, then they would send an army in to chastise these Canaanite kings. And so upon occasion, they would campaign in Canaan. And so on this occasion, of course, there was a problem. All of these kings came together in a coalition. We're trying to take over the region or whatever. I think before this, Canaan was sort of not a problem to the Egyptians. They could pass through there. We have, some records of previous pharaohs coming through on the way further north to do battle with the Hittites. But with this coalition then, it looked like maybe there was going to be some trouble in Canaan. So Thutmose III comes in and clobbers these guys and gets them all to swear allegiance. And from that point on, Egypt has a tighter control on these Canaanite kings that ruled these various city-states that we talked about that were there in the Middle Bronze period, and they continue into the Late Bronze period, although we have fewer now of these city-states. So I would begin the Late Bronze period then with that campaign of Thutmose III. That, to me, is a good watershed, because now we have Egyptian authority much stronger in the region, and there's maybe a destruction or two that we could date to this time, one in particular, Shechem. But as far as I can tell, most of the other destructions are much later. The destructions that Albright said were back in 1550, Kenyon said were back in 1550, looks to me like they're more like around 1400. Time will tell on that score. But at any rate, you'll see different dates for the beginning of Late Bronze I, 1550. In the review article that I think was in your assignment, the one by Deaver, for last week, he ends the Middle Bronze in 1500, which is interesting. Of course, that's a very round number that he sort of just pulls out of the air, but in doing so, he has disconnected the end of Middle Bronze with the expulsion of the Hyksos, because that was several decades before that. Even by the low chronology, it was something like the 10th year of Akhmosis, the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. And so even with the low chronology, it would be 1540 when the Hyksos were expelled from Egypt. So Deaver sees a problem with that old 1550 dating of the end of MB that Albright promoted, and people have more or less faithfully followed down through the years. But I think even in that article, Deaver says something about the pottery requires us to bring the date down somewhat lower than that, maybe around 1500. And he has even written in some other more recent articles that Middle Bronze may have come all the way down to the time of Thutmose III. Now, I think I've mentioned the work of Manfred Bitek at Tel El Daba in Egypt. That was the site of ancient Avaris, the Hyksos capital, and because of his findings there with the Canaanite pottery and so on, he's advocating lowering our dates for Middle Bronze, and he's suggesting as well that Middle Bronze probably came all the way down to the time of Thutmose III, although his latest article said we really should talk about a transitional between Middle Bronze and Late Bronze of some number of decades there, so he's kind of fuzzy about it. But I like to just define it somewhere and draw a line and say this is it, and for me, that campaign of Thutmose III is a very good place to draw the line and say this is the beginning then of Late Bronze I. Late Bronze, as you see on your chronology chart from last week, is divided into three main divisions. Late Bronze I, which almost everybody agrees, ends around 1400 BC. Then Late Bronze 2A would be simply the next century from around 1400 to about 1300. And then the final phase is usually labeled Late Bronze 2B from 1300 down to somewhere around 1200. Again, most books list 1200 as the end of the Late Bronze period. It's obviously a very round number. And again, with further study of the transition from Late Bronze to Iron Age, I think a much better point at which to end the Late Bronze Age is the 8th year of Ramses III, at which time the Philistines come into the land and the whole political situation changes, and we have, in fact, in the archaeological record, a number of changes. And I think this is an excellent point to define the end of Late Bronze and the beginning of the Iron Age. So I use 1177, or round it off to 1175, if you like, for the end of Late Bronze. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about the Philistines. Now, the point of transition from Late Bronze 2A to 2B, that 1300 figure, that comes from the time of Seti I. He campaigned in Canaan. And in fact, we have not only his records from Egypt, but we have a stela from Beth Shan that he erected there, which records the campaign, and something else from his reign, a statue or something. But anyway, we have material in Canaan as well as his own historical record in Egypt. So we do see a number of destructions around that time period. I doubt very seriously if Seti I destroyed all these places, because Canaan was a province, And the Egyptians were extracting taxes from this province and gaining support from these city-states. Why would they go up and destroy them? But scholars seem to have that interpretation so many times. They say, well, Seti I campaigned in Canaan. Here we have some destructions. Therefore, Seti I must be the one who caused these destructions. But you've got to get behind the reason for the campaign. Why did he go there? Again, we don't have a lot of information, but just common sense. He went up there because there was a problem. He had to reassert Egyptian authority. And I think you've got to go one step earlier and say whatever this problem was is probably what caused the destruction. Somebody was trying to overthrow the Egyptian rule or the vassal rulers or whatever, and they undoubtedly caused these destructions. And then Seti I is merely reacting to something that's going on in Canaan and brings his army up there and sets the thing straight, whatever the problem was. He doesn't give us all the reasons why he set out on this campaign. He just says, I went up here and I went to this place and that place. So I think we have to read between the lines of these documents to try to see the reality of the situation. At any rate, sometime around the rule of Seti I, we have destructions, and so that's where the 1300 comes from. Again, we just don't know all the details of what's happening there. Now, there's some important things here in this time period that we need to just quickly review. First of all, when Thutmose III took the throne, he was a very young child. And so there's a period of a co-regency between Thutmose III and his stepmother, Hatshepsut. In fact, Hatshepsut more or less rules the country as a pharaoh throughout that period between 1503 and 1482. She takes upon herself all the titles of a pharaoh in the Egyptian records. What few have remained concerning her, she has a masculine title, just as a pharaoh would have. She mysteriously disappears from the scene in about 1482 or 1483 or somewhere around there, quite suddenly, and Thutmose III now is the sole ruler. So we speak about the sole reign of Thutmose III or the period of co-regency. Hatshepsut was not well thought of. Whatever happened to her, we don't know, but her name was obliterated from all the monuments throughout Egypt. They were systematically hacked off, all the monuments. There's a lovely temple of hers, a mortuary temple down at Luxor, a lovely place, but I think they pretty much obliterated her name from most of the inscriptions, but we know it's hers, and they've been able to see her cartouches and so on, so they weren't really eradicating her totally from history, but they certainly tried. And this makes one wonder about what happened to her and whether or not Thutmose III or his followers or whatever maybe did away with her in some way. We don't know. But anyway, she disappears. And then immediately upon assuming the throne with a sole rulership there, Thutmose III campaigns in Canaan. That was his first year of his sole rule. It could be, again, we have to kind of read between the lines and try to look underneath and behind the records we have. It could be that Hatshepsut was simply not running things the way she should, and things were getting out of hand, and that somebody just had to get rid of her and put a stronger person on the throne. We just don't know. So after this campaign by Thutmose III, we have the Egyptians now in strong control
of Canaan in the late Bronze period, the very time of the Exodus and conquest and the initial entry of the Israelites into the land. Now, the way they maintained this control was through a vassalry, king vassal treaty, a suzerainty treaty between the Pharaoh and these petty Canaanite kings. Each city-state had a king of its own. Now, I might say, concerning the situation with these city-states, they still continue in the late Bronze, but we have fewer of them than we had back in middle Bronze. The area is not nearly as prosperous, and we don't have nearly as many people living in urban centers as we had in middle Bronze, but there's still quite a few strong city-states at this time. So we have quite a bit of information in the Egyptian records about the relationship between Pharaoh and these vassals. They were set up more or less as puppets by the Pharaoh. As long as they were true to Pharaoh and paid their taxes, they had no trouble, but if they would act up in any way, they would quickly be replaced. One policy the Egyptians had, very clever policy, I think, was to take the sons of these vassal kings and bring them to Egypt as young children, and they would train them in Egypt. So they, well, number one, had a hostage, and number two, they could train or brainwash or whatever you want to say these children until they reached the point where they were ready to take over the rule of their father's city-state, and then they could send them back. And they were thoroughly trained and indoctrinated at this point. And in fact, if the king died, then and the son was still in Egypt, they would immediately take the son and send him to Canaan. We have some recorded instances of that. So through these methods, they had a pretty tight control upon the land of Canaan. The Egyptians had, most of the time, only a nominal number of troops in Canaan, just some small forces. There, a number of officials. They didn't have a large contingent of bureaucrats or anything like that, but they had a few of them. We have references to them in various records. The way they maintained their presence there was through the Canaanite city-states, by taxing these city-states, and this tax was used to maintain their presence, their forces, their administrators, whatever they needed there in Canaan. So they did not have to take from Egypt or from their resources to maintain the control and administration of the province. Their primary interest, as I said, was maintaining the coastal route and the Israelon-Jezreel Valley. There was a road going out of Egypt, which the Egyptians called the Ways of Horus, H-O-R-U-S, one of their deities that they worshipped. And this road led from the border of Egypt up to Gaza, one of the cities taken over eventually by the Philistines. And this site of Gaza was the administrative center for the province of Canaan. Two other very important cities in the Israelon Valley were Megiddo and Beth Shan. In fact, Beth Shan was nothing but an Egyptian town. It's been quite thoroughly excavated. We've recovered a number of buildings and temples there with all kinds of Egyptian inscriptions on them, names of officials, and so on, and a lot of Egyptian artifacts and pottery. So there's no question but what the, you know, they used this as an administrative center, that they had troops and officials there. The Amarna letters from the 14th century give us a real insight into the political situation in Canaan. We'll have a whole lecture on the Amarna letters a little further along. I guess it's our last day of class. And we'll focus more or less on some other aspects of the Amarna letters at that time. But at this point, we can say that these letters are from these Canaanite kings back to Egypt. They were found at Amarna in Egypt, which was the capital of a pharaoh called Akhenaten. He should be on the list here. Amenhotep IV was his throne name, but he renamed himself Akhenaten. And that means may the sun god be glorified or something like that. It has to do with the worship of the sun, the Aten. And this particular pharaoh started a religious revival in Egypt by saying that they should worship only one god, the sun, and they should not worship any other god. The capital before his reign was at Thebes in Upper Egypt, and he moved the capital a little further north to the site that we call Amarna, that's the modern day name, and he named the new capital Akhetaten, again, the glorifying place of Aten, something like that has to do, again, with the sun. And so he set up a new capital where the sun would be the number one god and all the temples were dedicated to the worship of the sun. And so Akhenaten was all taken up with his new religion. Some have said that Moses learned monotheism from Akhenaten. And this is the kind of thing you can get into if you go with the late dating of the Exodus and Conquest, because then it would be possible if the Israelites didn't leave Egypt until 1270, that somehow they could have been influenced by this. But if you go with the biblical dating of things, the Israelites have already left in 1450, so they're not even there in the reign of Akhenaten to be influenced by his monotheism. At any rate, that's an interesting period when Akhenaten was ruling, and it's referred to as the Amarna period in Egyptian history. And in fact, the same term is used over in Palestine for that period of the 14th century B.C. It was accompanied not only by this religious revival, if you want to call it that, reform or new direction. There were great changes in art and in literature. This pharaoh was a realist, and he demanded that the artists portray things as they really looked. Now, prior to this time, they sort of portrayed things in an idealistic state. All the statues of the pharaohs looked like, you know, strong young men. Even when they were older, they still portrayed them this way as gods, you know, like the Greeks did, an idealized concept of the pharaoh. But not Akhenaten. In his day, they portrayed things as they really looked, and in fact, Akhenaten himself is portrayed realistically. And that is interesting. I think there's a picture maybe in here in the back of Akhenaten, because he was a bit grotesque, a bit deformed. He had a very narrow, long, narrow face. He had big hips and thighs, very effeminate looking. And some have said that he had some kind of a disease that brings out these features. I don't know too much about that aspect of it. But at any rate, that's the way he's depicted in the statues, in the tomb paintings, and so on, as he really looked as this sort of a, you know, almost grotesque figure. Now, he did have children, so I think sexually he was all right, but he does have these sort of effeminate features, and possibly due to some kind of a disease. Well, there at Amarna, in this new capital, beneath a building which was called the House of Records or something like that, in a pit, they discovered this archive of letters of communiques from the kings of Canaan, and other kings too, Syria and that whole region in this pit. And this gives us a window into the situation in Canaan and tells us a lot about what was happening in those times. And on and on and on. We'll look at some of these letters when we get to the 14th century. But they show the subservience of these kings to the Pharaoh, that relationship, and how the Egyptians maintained their control over the region of Canaan. Toward the end of the 13th century, things seem to be changing, and the Egyptians now send more people into Canaan to maintain their hold on the province, because we have a lot of structures that are built at this time which are definitely Egyptian. They're called residences, and we have a whole lot of them at various sites around Canaan. And it seems now that they're required to be there more, to have a stronger presence, because things are beginning to slip away. And I think this is a last-ditch effort to maintain their control of Canaan. Toward the end of the 13th century, we see the city-states beginning to collapse. One by one, they go under, beginning with, it appears, Hazor seems to be the first one to go under around 1230 B.C., and the story of Deborah and Barak, I think, is the reason for that. I think the Israelites overthrew Hazor. And then slowly the others disappear over a period of some time. Now, you will read in some books that the Late Bronze ended in 1200, Zippo, all at one time. But that's not the case at all. And in fact, my thesis was on this time period, the end of Late Bronze, beginning of Iron Age. When you really put a precise date on all of these destructions, you see that there's three different phases. One around 1230, 1220, maybe 1210, a bunch of destructions. Then there's another bunch at the time the Philistines came in around 1177. Then there's another bunch of destructions in the mid-12th century around 1150. And I think there's different things going on, different causes for these different waves of destruction. We know that Merneptah campaigned in Canaan around 1210 B.C. And again, this is an effort, I think, to reestablish Egyptian authority. Merneptah was the next pharaoh after Ramses the Great, Ramses II. Ramses II had the longest rule of any pharaoh of Egypt, something like 66 years. He was well into his 90s at the end of his reign, and it seems once again that Egypt was kind of relaxing her grip, wasn't paying attention to business, and toward the end of the reign of Ramses, things were getting out of hand up there, and that's exactly the time when the Israelites, under Deborah and Barak, overthrew Hazor, and it seems others were doing the same thing, because Merneptah, as soon as he took the throne, and he himself is in his 70s at this point, immediately goes to Canaan. We have the record of the campaign to Canaan in 1210, again, I think, to reestablish Egyptian control. But it's sort of like the beginning of the end. Things are getting out of hand. The next wave is around 1177, when the Philistines come in. And we won't have time to talk about the Philistines in this course. That will be part of part two, the Iron Age. But the Philistines have no trouble knocking off a whole lot of cities at this time, destroying them. They were intent on reaching Egypt and going into Egypt. They came out of the Aegean, evidently being displaced by the Dorians or something there in the Aegean. They are definitely from that region, and they came across Anatolia by land, and they came around the Mediterranean by sea, traveling in two different groups. but traveling together, and then they turned southward and came through Canaan, destroyed a lot of places, came right up to the border of Egypt, right up to the frontier, and were repulsed by Ramses III in his eighth year. And he devotes a lot of space on the walls of his mortuary temple at Midinat Habu with a record of this, pictures and inscriptions and just a lot of detail about repulsing these people. And in Papyrus Harris I, a big, long papyrus, recording events of his reign, again, he talks about this event. So he was able to keep them from entering Egypt, and then they settled on the coast of Canaan, as we know from the Bible. They set up these five cities, the Pentapolis of the Philistines, and so they settled along the coastal, southwest coastal area of Canaan. The theory has been that the Egyptians settled the Philistines as garrison troops. That was a way to explain their presence in this Egyptian territory. Because Gaza, as I said, was the Egyptian administrative center, and here it becomes a Philistine city. How do you explain that? Well, the way scholars have gotten around it is to say the Egyptians put them there intentionally as garrison troops. But the evidence simply does not support that particular theory. I have an article that came out in Bar last fall about that. The evidence indicates that the Philistines took this area by force of arms. The Egyptians had no say in the matter other than just to allow them to settle in this area. They took over some of the prime real estate of the region in that coastal plain. It's prime agricultural land. Plus, of course, they would have seaports, they'd have control of the sea lanes. They were astride the major coastal route that the Egyptians fought so hard to control. And here's the Philistines plopped right on the center of it. And so that indicates, I think, that the Egyptian control and authority is waning, and the Philistines are now coming into the fore. And in fact, just 25 years after this, the Egyptians are totally gone. With the final wave of destructions around 1150, which are associated with the disappearance of the Egyptians. Whether the Philistines drove them out and set fire to all their centers, or whether they just retreated and then the Egyptians burned their centers, I don't know, but I think the Philistines did it. And these destructions at around 1150 are all Egyptian places in Canaan. And this is the last we see of the Egyptians. 1150, they're gone. We have no indication of any kind of presence after 1150. And then the Philistines become the power of the region from that time until finally under David, the Israelites are able to overpower them at around 1000 B.C. So there's a change of the political orientation here, and that's why I feel this is a good point to draw a line and say the late bronze ends with the coming of the Philistines. That's the end of Egyptian rule, and the Philistines now become more powerful and more important in the area. So that's where I would end then the late bronze period, around 1175, say, in round numbers. So that's kind of a quick overview of the late bronze period. Now, when we talk about the Exodus and the conquest and all that, we'll be referring to some of these various pharaohs and what connections we have with Egyptian history. Okay, any questions on late Bronze Age?